This one. Resurrection and ascension play quite different, though of course closely related, roles within the thought of the early church. In fact, some kind of belief in Jesus' ascension has recently been shown to be not just a strange added extra to Christian belief, as has sometimes been thought, but a central and vital feature, without which all sorts of other things start to go demonstrably wrong. In his magisterial work, Ascension and Ecclesia, Professor Douglas Farrow of McGill University goes through the entire range of Christian thought on the subject, showing that where the ascension has been ignored or misunderstood, one can trace a slide into muddled and even dangerous ideas and practices. In our own day, the problem is not unlike the problems about the second coming, to which we shall presently turn. Flat literalism, on the one hand, facing modernist skepticism on the other, with each feeding off the other. Some people insist that Jesus must have done a kind of vertical takeoff, despite the fact that the same people know that he isn't now living somewhere in outer space, and despite the fact that a vertical takeoff in one part of the world would be a downward movement seen from the other side of the globe, and so on. Many people insist, and I dare say that this is the theology many of my readers have been taught, that the language of Jesus' disappearance is just a way of saying that after his death he became, as it were, spiritually present everywhere, especially with his own followers. This is then often correlated with a non-literal reading of the resurrection, that is, a denial of its bodily nature. Jesus simply went to heaven when he died, in a rather special sense that makes him now close to each of us wherever we are. According to this view, Jesus has, as it were, disappeared without remainder. His spiritual presence with us is his only identity. In that case, of course, to speak of his second coming is then only a metaphor for his presence, in the same sense, eventually permeating all things. What happens when people think like this? To answer this, we might ask a further question. Why has the ascension been such a difficult and unpopular doctrine in the modern Western Church? The answer is not just that rationalist skepticism mocks it, a possibility that the church has sometimes invited with those stained glass windows that show Jesus' feet sticking downward out of a cloud. It is that the ascension demands that we think differently about how the whole cosmos is, so to speak, put together, and that we also think differently about the church and about salvation. Both literalism and skepticism regularly operate with what is called a receptacle view of space. Theologians who take the ascension seriously insist that it demands what some have called a relational view. Basically, heaven and earth in biblical cosmology are not two different locations within the same continuum of space or matter. They are two different dimensions of God's good creation. And the point about heaven is twofold. First, heaven relates to earth tangentially, so that the one who is in heaven can be present simultaneously anywhere and everywhere on earth. The ascension therefore means that Jesus is available, accessible, without people having to travel to a particular spot on the earth to find him. Second, heaven is, as it were, the control room for earth. It is the CEO's office, the place from which instructions are given. All authority is given to me, said Jesus at the end of Matthew's Gospel, in heaven and on earth. The idea of the human Jesus now being in heaven, in his thoroughly embodied risen state, comes as a shock to many people, including many Christians. Sometimes this is because many people think that Jesus, having been divine, stopped being divine and became human, and then, having been human for a while, stopped being human and went back to being divine. At least that's what many people think Christians are supposed to believe. More often it's because our culture is so used to the Platonic idea that heaven is, by definition, a place of spiritual, non-material reality, so that the idea of a solid body being not only present, but also thoroughly at home there, seems like a category mistake. The ascension invites us to rethink all this, And, after all, why did we suppose we knew what heaven was? Only because our culture has suggested things to us. Part of Christian belief is to find out what's true about Jesus and let that challenge our culture. This applies in particular to the idea of Jesus being in charge not only in heaven but also on earth, not only in some ultimate future but also in the present. Many will snort the obvious objection. It certainly doesn't look as though he's in charge, or if he is, he's making a proper mess of it. But that misses the point. The early Christians knew the world was still a mess, but they announced, like messengers going off on behalf of a global company, that a new CEO had taken charge. They discovered through their own various callings how his new way of running things was to be worked out. It wasn't a matter, as some people anxiously suppose to this day, of Christians simply taking over and giving orders in a kind of theocracy where the church could simply tell everyone what to do. That has sometimes been tried, of course, and it's always led to disaster. But neither is it a matter of the church backing off, letting the world go on its sweet way, and worshipping Jesus in a kind of private sphere. Somehow, there is a third option, which we shall explore in the third part of the present book. We can glimpse it in the book of Acts. The method of the kingdom will match the message of the kingdom. The kingdom will come as the church, energized by the Spirit, goes out into the world vulnerable, suffering, praising, praying, misunderstood, misjudged, vindicated, celebrating. Always, as Paul puts it in one of his letters, bearing in the body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be displayed. What happens when you downplay or ignore the ascension? The answer is that the church expands to fill the vacuum. If Jesus is more or less identical with the church, if, that is, talk about Jesus can be reduced to talk about his presence within his people, rather than his standing over against them and addressing them from elsewhere as their Lord, then we have created a high road to the worst kind of triumphalism. This indeed is what 20th century English liberalism always tended toward. By compromising with rationalism and trying to maintain that talk of the ascension is really talk about Jesus being with us everywhere, the church effectively presented itself, with its structures and hierarchy, its customs and quirks, instead of presenting Jesus as its Lord and itself as the world's servant, as Paul puts it. And the other side of triumphalism is, of course, despair. If you put all your eggs into the church equals Jesus basket, what are you left with when, as Paul says in the same passage, we ourselves are found to be cracked earthenware vessels? If the church identifies its structures, its leadership, its liturgy, its buildings, or anything else with its Lord, and that's what happens if you ignore the ascension, or turn it into another way of talking about the Spirit, what do you get? You get, on the one hand, what Shakespeare called the insolence of office, and, on the other hand, the despair of late Middle Age, as people realize it doesn't work. I see this all too frequently among those who bought heavily into the soggy rationalism of the 1950s and 1960s. Only when we grasp firmly that the church is not Jesus, and Jesus is not the church, when we grasp, in other words, the truth of the ascension, that the one who is indeed present with us by the Spirit is also the Lord who is strangely absent, strangely other, strangely different from us and over against us, the one who tells Mary Magdalene not to cling to him, only then are we rescued from both hollow triumphalism and shallow despair. Conversely, only when we grasp and celebrate the fact that Jesus has gone on ahead of us into God's space, God's new world, and is both already ruling the rebellious present world as its rightful Lord, and also interceding for us at the Father's right hand, when we grasp and celebrate, in other words, what the ascension tells us about Jesus' continuing human work in the present, are we rescued from a wrong view of world history and equipped for the task of justice in the present. We'll come back to both of those later. We are also, significantly, rescued from the attempts that have been made to create alternative mediators, and in particular, an alternative mediatrix in his place. Get the ascension right, and your view of the church, of the sacraments, and of the mother of Jesus can get back into focus. You could sum all this up by saying that the doctrine of the Trinity, which is making quite a comeback in current theology, is essential if we are to tell the truth, not only about God and more particularly about Jesus, but also about ourselves. The Trinity is precisely a way of recognizing and celebrating the fact of the human being, Jesus of Nazareth, as distinct from, while still identified with, God the Father, on the one hand. He didn't just go back to being God again after his earthly life. And the Spirit, on the other hand, the Jesus who is near us and with us by the Spirit, remains the Jesus who is other than us. This places a full stop on all human arrogance, including Christian arrogance. And now we see at last why the Enlightenment world, which was determined to make the Ascension appear ridiculous, using the weapons of rationalism and skepticism to do so. If the Ascension is true, then the whole project of human self-aggrandizement, represented by 18th century European and American thought, is rebuked and brought to heel. To embrace the Ascension is to heave a sigh of relief, to give up the struggle to be God, and with it the inevitable despair at our constant failure, and to enjoy our status as creatures, image-bearing creatures, but creatures nonetheless. The Ascension thus speaks of the Jesus who remains truly human, and hence, in an important sense, absent from us, while in another equally important sense, present to us in a new way. At this point, the Holy Spirit and the sacraments become enormously important, since they are precisely the means by which Jesus is present. Often in the Church we have been so keen to stress the presence of Jesus by these means that we have failed to indicate his simultaneous absence and have left people wondering whether this is, so to speak, all there is to it. The answer is no, it isn't. The Lordship of Jesus, the fact that there is already a human being at the helm of the world, his present intercession for us, all this is over and above his presence with us. It is even over and above our sense of that presence, which of course comes and goes with our own moods and circumstances. Now it is of course one thing to say all this, to show how it fits together and sets us free from some of the nonsenses we would otherwise get into. It's quite another to be able to envisage or imagine it, to know what it is we're really talking about when we speak of Jesus being still human, still in fact an embodied human, actually a more solidly embodied human than we are, but absent from this present world. We need, in fact, a new and better cosmology, a new and better way of thinking about the world than the one our culture, not least post-Enlightenment culture, has bequeathed us. The early Christians and their fellow first-century Jews were not, as many moderns suppose, locked into thinking of a three-decker universe with heaven up in the sky and hell down beneath their feet. When they spoke of up and down like that, they, like the Greeks in their different ways, were using metaphors that were so obvious they didn't need spelling out. As some recent writers have pointed out, when a pupil at school moves up a grade from, say, the 10th grade to the 11th, it is unlikely that this means relocating to a classroom on the floor above. And though the move up from vice chairman of the board to chairman of the board may indeed mean that at last you get an office in the penthouse suite, it would be quite wrong to think that moving up in this context meant merely being a few feet farther away from terra firma. The mystery of the Ascension is, of course, just that, a mystery. It demands that we think what is to many today almost unthinkable, that when the Bible speaks of heaven and earth, it is not talking about two localities related to each other within the same space-time continuum, or about a non-physical world contrasted with a physical one, but about two different kinds of what we call space, two different kinds of what we call matter, and also quite possibly, though this does not necessarily follow from the other two, two different kinds of what we call time. We post-Enlightenment Westerners are such wretched flatlanders. Although New Age thinkers, and indeed quite a lot of contemporary novelists, are quite capable of taking us into other parallel worlds, spaces and times, we retreat into our rationalistic closed system universe as soon as we think about Jesus. C.S. Lewis, of course, did a great job in the Narnia stories and elsewhere of imagining how two worlds could relate and interlock. But the generation that grew up knowing its way around Narnia does not usually know how to make the transition from a children's story to the real world of grown-up Christian devotion and theology. Some church buildings do their best to indicate the interrelation of heaven and earth. The Eastern Orthodox churches do it by envisaging heaven as the inner sanctuary, the space around the altar, and earth as the part of the building outside that space. The two are separated by the iconostasis, upon which are portrayed the saints, whose presence in heaven is not far from the worshippers on earth. Western cathedrals and abbeys often did a similar thing through soaring Gothic architecture, giving us at floor level a sense of belonging within, but unable at the moment to inhabit more than a little of, great spaces of light and beauty, into which, significantly, only our music can penetrate. All such aids to the Christian imagination are to be welcomed as long, of course, as they are not mistaken for the real thing. What we are encouraged to grasp precisely through the ascension itself is that God's space and ours, heaven and earth, in other words, are, though very different, not far away from one another. Nor is talk about heaven simply a metaphorical way of talking about our own spiritual lives. God's space and ours interlock and intersect in a whole variety of ways, even while they retain, for the moment at least, their separate and distinct identities and roles. One day, as we saw in the last chapter, they will be joined in a quite new way, open and visible to one another, married together forever. One day, in other words, the Jesus who is right now the central figure of God's space, the human Jesus, still wearing, as Wesley put it, those dear tokens of his passion on his dazzling body, will be present to us, and we to him, in a radically different way than what we currently know. The other half of the truth of the ascension is that Jesus will return, as the angel said, in Acts chapter 1, verse 11. At this point, some of the regular prayers in my tradition let us down with a bump, which is actually the wrong metaphor, because what they do is to say, in effect, Jesus has been raised to heaven, and we pray that we may be raised there too. There is indeed a sense in which this is true, as in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 6, and Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. But when people hear those prayers today, speaking of Jesus being exalted to heaven, and of us going in heart and mind to be with him forever, or speaking of the Holy Spirit as the one who will exalt us to the place where he has gone before, they are almost bound within today's muddled worldview to be reinforced in their view that the whole point of the Christian faith is to follow Jesus away from earth to heaven and stay there forever. And the New Testament insists, on the contrary, that the one who has gone into heaven will come back. At no point in the Gospels or Acts does anyone say anything remotely like, Jesus has gone into heaven, so let's be sure we can follow him. They say rather, Jesus is in heaven, ruling the whole world, and he will one day return to make that rule complete. But what is this second coming all about? Isn't that too a strange, outlandish idea that we should abandon in our own day? What about the second coming? Christ has died, we say in the Anglican Eucharist. Christ is risen, Christ will come again. And of course, in the Creed, too, he will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead. If we sing it once during the season of Advent, we sing it a dozen times, Alleluia, come, Lord, come. And if we are ordinary mainstream Christians in Britain today, and in many other places too, including parts of North America, we may well add under our breath, even though I haven't a clue what it means. The so-called second coming of Jesus is not a hot topic in the preaching of the mainstream churches, even in Advent. Some churches, of course, speak of little else. I shall come to them presently. The more recent lectionaries we use in my church rather steer us away from it. What's more, the revival of a lively Eucharistic life in the Church of England in the post-war years carried with it, in some circles at least, a theology that seemed to leave no room for a final coming. "Why do we say Christ will come again?" asked one puzzled worshipper in the 1970s, when the threefold phrase was first used in Anglican liturgy. "Surely we've been taught that he comes, that he is here with us, in the Eucharist itself. What then can we say about the second coming of Jesus?" We have reached the point in this book where we can address this question within the larger framework where it makes sense. We have looked in earlier chapters at the beliefs about life after death and the future of the world that are held in our own time and that were held in Jesus' day. We have seen that there are good historical arguments pointing to belief in Jesus' bodily resurrection. In particular, I sketched in the last chapter the large-scale future hope of Christians, the hope for the renewal of the whole world. Now, before we turn to examine more particularly the hope or the fate of the individual within this scheme of thought, we come to one central and vital aspect of the large-scale hope. When God renews the whole cosmos, the New Testament insists, Jesus himself will be personally present as the center and focus of the new world that will result. What does the Christian faith teach at this point? What is its sharp edge for us today? How can we make it our own? Answering these questions has become more difficult in the past century. There are two reasons for this, more or less equal and opposite. One reason is that the second coming of Jesus Christ has become the favorite topic of a large swathe of North American Christianity, particularly but not exclusively in the fundamentalist and dispensationalist segment. Growing out of some millenarian movements of the 19th century, particularly those associated with J.N. Darby and the Plymouth Brethren, a belief has arisen and taken hold of millions of minds and hearts that we are now living in the end times, in which all the great prophecies are to be fulfilled at last. Central to these prophecies, it is believed, is the promise that Jesus will return in person, snatching the true believers away from this wicked world to be with him, and then, after an interval of ungodliness, returning to reign over the world forever. The attempt to correlate these prophecies with the geopolitical events of the 1960s and 1970s, which reached a height in Hal Lindsey's best-selling book, The Late Great Planet Earth, has somewhat palled, but its place has been taken by the fictional scenarios offered by a series of books by Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins. The first volume of the series, called Left Behind, gave its name to a sequence of 12 books in all, most of which have done astonishingly well in the current American bestseller lists. In their fictitious scenario, the rapture has happened. All true Christians have been snatched away from the earth, and those left behind are now struggling to survive in a godless world. This is an exciting and entertaining scenario. I leave it to others to probe the social and political psychology that is going on when pseudo-theological fiction takes off like this. Nor is it purely an American phenomenon. The books sell quite well in the United Kingdom too, though who is buying them in my own country I do not know. The American obsession, I don't think that's too strong a word, with the second coming of Jesus, or rather with one particular, and, as we shall see, highly distorted interpretation of it, continues unabated. I first met it in person when I was giving some lectures in Thunder Bay, Ontario, in the early 1980s. I was talking about Jesus in his historical context, and to my surprise, almost all the questions afterward were about ecology, about trees and water and crops, which is, after all, what there mostly is at Thunder Bay. It turned out, as I indicated in the previous chapter, that many conservative Christians in the area, and more importantly just to the south in the United States, had been urging that since we were living in the end times, with the world about to come to an end, there was no point worrying about trying to stop polluting the planet with acid rain and the like. Indeed, wasn't it unspiritual, and even a sign of a lack of faith, to think about such things? If God was intending to bring the whole world to a shuddering halt, what was the problem? If Armageddon was just around the corner, it didn't matter. And here, I suspect, is part of the real agenda. If General Motors went on pumping poisonous gases into the Canadian atmosphere. We face similar questions today. So-called end-time speculation, which is the daily bread of many in the American religious right, is not unconnected to the agenda of some of America's leading politicians. More of that anon. For many millions of believing Christians in today's world, the Second Coming is part of a scenario in which the present world is doomed to destruction, while the chosen few are snatched up to heaven. Partly in reaction against such an idea, but partly powered by the energy of good old Enlightenment liberalism, many in the mainstream churches of the West have for some time been doing their best to divest themselves of the doctrine that Jesus Christ will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead, at least in any recognizable form. Both parts are disliked, the coming and the judging. The idea that Jesus will come to this world, invading it like a spaceman, smacks to many of an older supernatural or interventionist theology, which they have spent a lifetime rejecting, or at best reinterpreting. They don't imagine that Jesus is still, so to speak, around the place somewhere in that way. The language of his coming must therefore be reinterpreted in terms of a general hope for world renewal. After all, they say, the early church expected Jesus to come very soon, and he didn't. We should obviously reinterpret their hope in a way that makes sense 2,000 years later. In addition, the idea of judgment makes many people think of a vengeful, wrathful deity determined to throw as many people as possible into hell. We have learned to distrust people who love accusing and punishing others. In the same way, we have learned to dislike and distrust theologies in which accusing and punishing take center stage. The Hebrew for the accuser is, after all, ha-Satan, the Satan. We are therefore faced, as we look at today's large-scale picture, with two polar opposites. At one end, some have made the Second Coming so central that they can see little else. At the other, some have so marginalized or weakened it that it ceases to mean anything at all. Both positions need to be challenged. I shall shortly show that the focus on the so-called rapture is based on a misunderstanding of two verses in Paul, and that when we get that misunderstanding out of the way, we can find a doctrine of Jesus' coming that remains central and vital if the whole Christian faith is not to unravel before our eyes. At the same time, the older Enlightenment liberalism, with its dislike of all judgment, has itself been under attack. We have become a very moralistic, very judgmental generation. We have judged apartheid and found it wanting. We judge child abusers and find them guilty. We judge genocide and find it outrageous. We have rediscovered what the psalmists knew, that for God to judge the world meant that he would, in the end, put it all to rights, straighten it out, producing not just a sigh of relief all around, but shouting for joy from the trees and the fields, the seas and the floods. At the same time, we may not as a culture be fond of old-fashioned supernaturalism, but we certainly like spirituality in whatever form we can get it. I suspect that if anyone other than Jesus, Krishna, say, or Buddha, were suddenly put forward as being due for a second coming, millions in our post-secular society would embrace such a thing uncritically, leaving Enlightenment rationalism huffing and puffing in the rear. We are a puzzled and confused generation, embracing any and every kind of non-rationalism that may offer us a spiritual shot in the arm, while lapsing back into rationalism, in particular the old modernist critiques, whenever we want to keep traditional or orthodox Christianity at bay. And yet it is Christian orthodoxy, properly understood, that can help us find the way through this morass and muddle and out the other side. But before we get any further, I need to say a word about a word, a much misunderstood word, a word that may get in the way unless we demystify it. I refer to the blessed term eschatology. The word eschatology has often been used in relation to early Christianity to mean the expectation of the return of Jesus within a generation and the redefinitions that took place when this did not happen. This expectation, it used to be thought, was based on and gave new focus to the expectation of first century Jews that the world was about to come to an end. When I wrote The New Testament and the People of God in 1992, I argued that though the early Christians did indeed expect Jesus' return, they were not bothered by its not happening within a generation, and indeed that the Jewish expectation they had inherited was not about the end of the world, but about a dramatic change within the present world order. An Oxford colleague who read the book said to me, "Now that you've abandoned eschatology," meaning apparently, "now that you've abandoned the idea that first century Jews and Christians expected the world to end at once." I insisted then, and I insist now, that I have done no such thing. The word eschatology, which literally means the study of the last things, doesn't just refer to death, judgment, heaven and hell, as used to be thought, and as many dictionaries still define the word. It also refers to the strongly held belief, as most first century Jews, and virtually all early Christians, that history was going somewhere under the guidance of God, and that where it was going was toward God's new world of justice, healing, and hope. The transition from the present world to the new one would be a matter not of the destruction of the present space-time universe, but of its radical healing. As we saw in the last chapter, the New Testament writers, particularly Paul, looked forward to this time and saw Jesus' resurrection as the beginning, the first fruits of it. So when I, and many others, use the word eschatology, we don't simply mean the second coming, still less a particular theory about it. We mean, rather, the entire sense of God's future for the world, and the belief that that future has already begun to come forward to meet us in the present. This is what we find in Jesus himself and in the teaching of the early church. They modified, but did not abandon, the Jewish eschatological beliefs they already shared. So how can we understand the second coming? How, for that matter, do the biblical writers themselves understand it? This will take a further chapter to set out. 8. When He Appears. Introduction. Two chapters ago I sketched the big picture of cosmic redemption that the New Testament invites us to make our own. God will redeem the whole universe. Jesus' resurrection is the beginning of that new life, the fresh grass growing through the concrete of corruption and decay in the old world. That final redemption will be the moment when heaven and earth are joined together at last in a burst of God's creative energy for which Easter is the prototype and source. When we put together that big picture with what we've said in the previous chapter about the ascension of Jesus, what do we get? Why, of course, the personal presence of Jesus as opposed to his current absence. The presence we know at the moment, the presence of Jesus with his people in word and sacrament, by the Spirit, through prayer, in the faces of the poor, is of course related to that future presence, but the distinction between them is important and striking. Jesus' appearing will be, for those of us who have known and loved him here, like meeting face to face someone we have only known by letter, telephone, or perhaps email. Communication theorists insist that for full human communication, you need not only words on a page, but also a tone of voice. That's why a telephone call can say more than a letter, not in quantity, but in quality. But for full communication between human beings, you need not only a tone of voice, but also body language, facial language, and the thousand small ways in which, without realizing it, we relate to one another. At the moment, by the Spirit, the Word, the sacraments and prayer, and in those in need whom we are called to serve for his sake, The absent Jesus is present to us, but one day he will be there with us, face to face. Cecil Frances Alexander got it partly right in her classic 19th century compromise. And our eyes at last shall see him through his own redeeming love, for that child so dear and gentle is our Lord in heaven above. Unless we feel the pull and yearning of those lines, we may not yet have learned to know him as we may know him in the present, or to feel the tension between our present knowing and that which is promised in the future. But the hymn is quite wrong to suggest that for this knowledge we need to go and find him. And he leads his children on to the place where he is gone. This is indeed true, as we shall see, of what happens to his people after death, in the interim state. But it isn't the main truth that the New Testament teaches, the main emphasis that the early Christians insisted on over and over again. The main truth is that he will come back to us. That is the thing of which we must now speak in two main movements. He will come again, and he will come again as judge. Coming, appearing, revealing, royal presence. We still speak in our culture about the sun rising and setting, even though we know that in fact it is we on our planet who are moving in relation to the sun rather than the other way around. In the same way, the early Christians often spoke of Jesus coming or returning. Indeed, at least in John's Gospel, Jesus himself speaks in that way. But the larger picture they use suggests that if we are to understand them properly, that language, common and even creedal though it is, may not be the most helpful way today of getting at the truth it affirms. In fact, the New Testament uses quite a variety of language and imagery to express the truth that Jesus and his people will one day be personally present to each other as full and renewed human beings. It is perhaps an accident of history that the phrase "the second coming," which is very rare in the New Testament, has come to dominate discussion. When that phrase is identified, as it has often been in the United States, with a particular view of that coming as a literal downward descent, meeting halfway with the redeemed who are making a simultaneous upward journey, all sorts of problems arise that are avoided if we take the New Testament's multiple witness as a whole. The first thing to get clear is that, despite widespread opinion to the contrary, during his earthly ministry, Jesus said nothing about his return. I have argued this position at length and in detail in my various books about Jesus, and don't have space to substantiate it here. Let me just say two things, quite boldly. First, when Jesus speaks of the Son of Man coming on the clouds, he is talking not about the second coming, but, in line with the Daniel chapter 7 text he is quoting, about his vindication after suffering. The coming is an upward, not a downward movement. In context, the key texts mean that though Jesus is going to his death, he will be vindicated by events that will take place afterward. What those events are remains cryptic from the point of view of the passages in question, which is one good reason for thinking them authentic, but they certainly include both Jesus' resurrection and the destruction of the temple, the system that opposed him, and his mission. And the language, significantly, is precisely the language the early church used as the least inadequate way of talking about the strange thing that happened after Jesus' resurrection. His ascension, his glorification, his coming not to earth, but to heaven, to the Father. Second, the stories Jesus tells about a king or master who goes away for a while and leaves his subjects or servants to trade with his money in his absence were not originally meant to refer to Jesus going away and leaving the church with tasks to get on with until his eventual second coming, even though they were read in that way from fairly early on. They belong in the Jewish world of the first century, where everyone would hear the story to be about God himself, having left Israel and the temple at the time of the exile, coming back again at last, as the post-exilic prophets had said he would, back to Israel, back to Zion, back to the temple. In their original setting, the point of these stories is that Israel's God, Yahweh, is indeed coming at last to Jerusalem, to the temple, in and as the human person, Jesus of Nazareth. The stories are, in that sense, not about the second coming of Jesus, but about the first one. They are explaining, albeit cryptically, Jesus' own belief that what he was doing in coming to Jerusalem to enact both judgment and salvation was what Yahweh had said in Scripture that he would do in person. These two historical moves, about the Son of Man sayings and about the parables of the returning master or king, have left me open to the attack, particularly from American readers, that I have thereby given up believing or teaching the second coming. This is absurd, as the present chapter will make clear. The fact that Jesus didn't teach it doesn't mean it isn't true. Similarly, the fact that I have written books about Jesus without mentioning it doesn't mean I don't believe in it. When a football commentator goes through a whole game without mentioning baseball, that doesn't mean he doesn't believe it exists, or that he doesn't rate it highly as a sport. Jesus was having a hard enough time explaining to his disciples that he had to die. They never really grasped that at all, and they certainly didn't take his language about his own resurrection as anything more than the general hope of all Jewish martyrs. How could they possibly have understood him saying something about further events in what would have been for them a still more unthinkable future? Of course, when Jesus came to Zion as Israel's rightful Lord in the first century, that event did indeed point forward to his eventual return as the rightful Lord of the whole world. This means that, if we are careful what we are doing, we can read the parables I've mentioned in this new way if we so desire. The reason we need to be careful, though, is because they don't quite fit. Nowhere in the New Testament does any writer say that at Jesus' final coming, some of his servants, some actual believing Christians, will be judged in the way that the wicked servant was judged for hiding his master's money in a napkin. Nor will it do to say, as do some who grasp part of the point, but have not worked it through, that the events of A.D. 70 were themselves the second coming of Jesus, so that ever since then we have been living in God's new age, and there is no further coming to await. This may seem to many readers, as indeed it seems to me, a bizarre position to hold, but there are some who not only hold it, but also eagerly propagate it and use some of my arguments to support it. This results from a confusion. If the texts that speak of the Son of Man coming on the clouds refer to A.D. 70, as I have argued that in part they do, this doesn't mean that A.D. 70 was the second coming, because the Son of Man texts aren't second coming texts at all, despite their frequent misreading that way. They are about Jesus' vindication, and Jesus' vindication in his resurrection, ascension, and judgment on Jerusalem requires a still further event for everything to be complete. Let me say it emphatically for the sake of those who are confused on the point, and to the amusement, no doubt, of those who are not. The second coming has not yet occurred. So if the gospel accounts of Jesus' teaching do not refer to the second coming, where does the idea come from? Quite simply, from the rest of the New Testament. As soon as Jesus had been vindicated, raised, and exalted, the church firmly believed and taught that he would return. "This same Jesus who has gone from you into heaven," said the angel to the disciples, "will return in the same way that you saw him go into heaven." And though Acts doesn't often refer again to this belief, clearly the whole book takes place under this rubric. This is what the disciples are doing to make Jesus' lordship known in all the world, against the day when he will come once more to renew all things. But of course the primary witness is Paul. Paul's letters are full of the future coming or appearing of Jesus. His worldview, his theology, his missionary practice, his devotion are all inconceivable without it. Yet what he has to say about this great event has often been misunderstood, not least by the proponents of rapture theology. It's almost time to address this directly, but first a word about another major and often misunderstood technical term. Scholars and simple folk alike can get led astray by the use of a single word to refer to something when that word in its original setting means both more and less than the use to which it is subsequently put. In this case, the word in question is the Greek word parousia. This is usually translated coming, but literally it means presence, that is, presence as opposed to absence. The word parousia occurs in two of the key passages in Paul, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 verse 15 and 1 Corinthians chapter 15 verse 23. And it is found frequently elsewhere in Paul and the New Testament. It seems clear that the early Christians knew the word well and knew what was meant by it. People often assume that the early church used parousia simply to mean the second coming of Jesus, and that by this event they all envisaged, in a quite literal fashion, the scenario of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 verses 16 to 17, Jesus coming down on a cloud and people flying upward to meet him. Neither of these assumptions is in fact correct. The word parousia had two lively meanings in non-Christian discourse at the time. Both of these seem to have influenced it in its Christian meaning. The first meaning was the mysterious presence of a god or divinity, particularly when the power of this god was revealed in healing. People would suddenly be aware of a supernatural and powerful presence, and the obvious word for this was parousia. Josephus sometimes uses this word when he is talking about Yahweh coming to the rescue of Israel. God's powerful saving presence is revealed in action. For instance, when Israel under King Hezekiah was miraculously defended against the Assyrians. The second meaning emerges when a person of high rank makes a visit to a subject state, particularly when a king or emperor visits a colony or province. The word for such a visit is royal presence, in Greek, parousia. In neither setting, we note, obviously but importantly, is there the slightest suggestion of anybody flying around on a cloud, nor is there any hint of the imminent collapse or destruction of the space-time universe. Now suppose that Paul, and for that matter the rest of the early church, wanted to say two things. Suppose they wanted to say first that the Jesus they worshipped was near in spirit but absent in body, but that one day he would be present in body, and that then the whole world, themselves included, would know the sudden transforming power of that presence. A natural word to use for this would be parousia. At the same time, suppose they wanted to say that the Jesus who had been raised from the dead and exalted to God's right hand was the rightful Lord of the world, the true emperor before whom all other emperors would shake in their shoes and bow their knees in fear and wonder. And suppose they wanted to say that, just as Caesar might one day visit a colony like Philippi, or Thessalonica, or Corinth, the normally absent but ruling emperor appearing and ruling in person, so the absent but ruling lord of the world would one day appear and rule in person within this world, with all the consequences that would result. Again, the natural word to use for this would be parousia. This was particularly significant in that Paul and the others were keen to say that Jesus was the true Lord, and that Caesar was a sham. Now these things are not just suppositions. This is exactly how it was. Paul and the others used the word parousia because they wanted to evoke these worlds, but they evoked them within a different context. For neither the first nor the last time, the Jewish storyline and the Greco-Roman allusions and confrontations meet like two tectonic plates, throwing up the craggy mountain range we call New Testament theology. The Jewish storyline in question was, of course, the story of the day of the Lord, the day of Yahweh, the day when Yahweh would defeat all Israel's enemies and rescue his people once and for all. Paul and the other writers regularly refer to the day of the Lord, and now, of course, they mean it in a Christian sense. The Lord here is Jesus himself. In this sense, and in this sense only, there is a solid Jewish background for the Christian doctrine of the second coming of Jesus. Of course, there could be nothing stronger because pre-Christian Judaism, including the disciples during Jesus' lifetime, never envisaged the death of the Messiah. That is why they never thought of his resurrection, let alone an interim period between such events and the final consummation, during which he would be installed as the world's true Lord, while still waiting for that sovereign rule to take full effect. What happened, it seems, was this. The early Christians had lived within and breathed and prayed that old Jewish storyline. In the resurrection and ascension of Jesus, shocking and unexpected though they were, they grasped the fact that in this way Israel's God had indeed done what he'd always intended, though it hadn't looked like they thought it would. Through this, they came to see that Jesus, as Israel's Messiah, was already the world's true Lord, and that his secret presence by his Spirit in the present time was only a hint of what was still to come, when he would finally be revealed as the one whose power would trump all other powers, both earthly and heavenly. The Jesus story thus created a radical intensification and transformation from within the Jewish story, and the language that results in describing the Jesus event that is yet to come is the language that says in relation to the future, Jesus is Lord and Caesar isn't. Parousia is itself, in fact, one of those terms in which Paul is able to say that Jesus is the reality of which Caesar is the parody. His theology of the second coming is part of his political theology of Jesus as Lord. In other words, we have the language of parousia, of royal presence, sitting in a typically Pauline juxtaposition with the language of Jewish apocalyptic. This would not, I think, have presented many problems for Paul's first hearers. It has certainly created problems for subsequent readers, not least in the last century or so. This is so especially when we read 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 to 17. The Lord himself will come down from heaven with a shouted order, with the voice of an archangel and the sound of God's trumpet. The Messiah's dead will rise first, then we who are alive, who are left, will be snatched up with them among the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and in this way we shall always be with the Lord. The point to notice above all about these tricky verses is that they are not to be taken as a literal description of what Paul thinks will happen. They are simply a different way of saying what he is saying in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 verses 23 to 27 and verses 51 to 54 and in Philippians chapter 3 verses 20 to 21. We had better get those other passages straight in our minds to start with. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15 verses 23 to 27, Paul speaks of the parousia of the Messiah as the time of the resurrection of the dead, the time when his present, though secret, rule will become manifest in the conquest of the last enemies, especially death. Then in verses 51 to 54, he speaks of what will happen to those who, at Jesus' coming, are not yet dead. They will be changed, transformed. This is clearly the same event as he is speaking of in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. We have the trumpet in both, and the resurrection of the dead in both. But whereas in 1 Thessalonians he speaks of those presently alive being snatched up in the air, in 1 Corinthians he speaks of them being transformed. So too in Philippians chapter 3 verse 21, where the context is quite explicitly ranging Jesus over against Caesar, Paul speaks of the transformation of the present lowly body to be like Jesus' glorious body as a result of his all-conquering power. So why does Paul speak in this peculiar way in 1 Thessalonians about the Lord descending and the living saints being snatched up in the air? I suggest that he is finding richly metaphorical ways of alluding to three other stories that he is deliberately bringing together. Paul was good at richly mixed metaphors. In the next chapter, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, he says that the thief will come in the night, so the woman will go into labor, so you mustn't get drunk, but must stay awake and put on your armor. As the television programs say, don't try that one at home. We must remind ourselves yet once more that all Christian language about the future is a set of signposts pointing into a mist. Signposts don't normally provide you with advance photographs of what you'll find at the end of the road, but that doesn't mean they aren't pointing in the right direction. They are telling you the truth, the particular sort of truth that can be told about the future. The three stories Paul is here bringing together start with the story of Moses coming down the mountain. The trumpet sounds, a loud voice is heard, and after a long wait Moses appears and descends from the mountain to see what's been going on in his absence. Then there is the story of Daniel chapter 7, in which the persecuted people of God are vindicated over their pagan enemy by being raised up on the clouds to sit with God in glory. This raising up on the clouds, which Jesus applies to himself in the Gospels, is now applied by Paul to the Christians who are presently suffering persecution. Putting these two stories together, in a typically outrageous mix of metaphors, enables Paul to bring in the third story, to which we have already alluded. When the emperor visited a colony or province, the citizens of the country would go to meet him at some distance from the city. It would be disrespectful to have him actually arrive at the gates, as though his subjects couldn't be bothered to greet him properly. When they met him, they wouldn't then stay out in the open country, they would escort him royally into the city itself. When Paul speaks of meeting the Lord in the air, the point is precisely not, as in the popular rapture theology, that the saved believers would then stay up in the air somewhere, away from earth. The point is that, having gone out to meet their returning Lord, they will escort him royally into his domain, that is, back to the place they have come from. Even when we realize that this is highly charged metaphor, not literal description, the meaning is the same as in the parallel in Philippians chapter 3 verse 20. Being citizens of heaven, as the Philippians would know, doesn't mean that one is expecting to go back to the mother city, but rather means that one is expecting the emperor to come from the mother city to give the colony its full dignity, to rescue it, if need be, to subdue local enemies and put everything to rights. These two verses in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, then, have been grievously abused by those who have constructed out of them a big picture of a supposed rapture. This has had its effect not only on popular fundamentalism, but also on a fair amount of New Testament scholarship, which has assumed that Paul really meant what the fundamentalists think he meant. Only when we put together the several different things he says on the same topic does the truth emerge. This is a typical piece of highly charged and multiply elusive rhetoric. The reality to which it refers is this: Jesus will be personally present, the dead will be raised, and the living Christians will be transformed. That, as we shall now see, is pretty much what the rest of the New Testament says as well. Note, though, something else of great significance about the whole Christian theology of resurrection, ascension, second coming, and hope. This theology was born out of confrontation with the political authorities, out of the conviction that Jesus was already the true Lord of the world, who would one day be manifested as such. The rapture theology avoids this confrontation because it suggests that Christians will miraculously be removed from this wicked world. Perhaps that is why such theology is often Gnostic in its tendency toward a private, dualistic spirituality, and toward a political laissez-faire quietism. And perhaps that is partly why such theology, with its dreams of Armageddon, has quietly supported the political status quo in a way that Paul would never have done. Before turning away from Paul, notice a significant pair of passages. First, at the end of 1 Corinthians, Paul suddenly writes a phrase in Aramaic, Maranatha. It means, Our Lord, come, and goes back, like the word Abba, Father, to the very early Aramaic-speaking church. There is no reason why the Greek-speaking church would have invented a prayer in Aramaic. We must be in touch at this point with extremely early and pre-Pauline tradition. The early church was from the beginning praying to Jesus that he would return. Second, a very different passage in Colossians chapter 3. Here we have in a nutshell Paul's theology of resurrection and ascension as applied to present Christian living and future Christian hope. If you've been raised with the Messiah, seek the things that are above, because that's where the Messiah is, sitting at God's right hand. Think about the things above, not about the things below, for you died, and your life is hidden with the Messiah in God. When the Messiah appears, hotan ho Christos phanerothi, the one who is your life, then you too will appear with him in glory. This is clearly in the same ballpark as the other texts we've been looking at. But notice the key thing, that instead of coming, or the blessed word parousia,